journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, November 20th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
How the Senate health bill compares to the House bill. A new ruling holding the Army Corps of Engineers responsible for Katrina flooding. And did Big Oil end up winning in Iraq? Plus this week's Black Agenda report.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The campus of UCLA yesterday was rife with activity as Regents took a final vote to pass a whopping 32% fee hike. They met at Covell Commons, where students and union workers surrounded the area after news of the vote and blocked the Regents from leaving for 2 hours. Over at Campbell Hall, several dozen students took over the space and renamed it Carter Huggins Hall after Black Panthers Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, who were killed there 40 years ago. I spoke yesterday at noon with two students who are among those occupying the hall.
My name is Alex. I'm a UCLA student.
Where are you right now, and what exactly are you doing there?
Well, we're in Campbell Hall, which we've renamed Carter Huggins Hall, in memoriam for what happened here in the 60s. So there's a historical dimension to what we're doing, but we're... If you look at our statement, I recommend that you do. It's on the web now and on our Facebook page. We talk about not having a sort of strict, limited, defined set of demands. We don't have any illusions about the Regents sort of rescinding this incredible fee hike or about their even their ability to do so. Our demands are sort of broader than that, and they involve, first of all, taking space and making it our own. Transforming space, making people, I suppose, empowered, but also aware that the university belongs to them, and that we can control it if we want to, and that an alternative is possible. So, to us, that's a lot more dangerous and a lot more powerful than simply, you know, saying reverse the hikes, stop the furloughs, because those demands are easily refused, and it easily diffuses a movement that's based on real grievances and real deep feelings of injustice and inequality. So that's, I think, what we're doing here, to put it in broad terms.
Can you describe how many of you there are and what the situation is like, if there have been any campus authorities that have come to try to evict you?
We have been felt out, I think, by police, we haven't been rushed. Yesterday in Covell, there were actual confrontations. There hasn't been that yet. We're numerous. We're growing. I can't say exactly how many people are here, but we're looking to increase the number of people, and we're hoping that the people at Covell will come and join us, and both outside and inside, and that we can continue having occupying the space and learning from that occupation, learning through acting, not just having meetings, not just talking, but also doing.
My name is Nick, and we're in a building at UCLA, and it's being occupied by students as a statement to say that what we see is going on in our education system, not just UC, CSU's community college, but education system in general, as well as all public institutions. They're kind of falling into deplorable rates, and it makes us really nervous, and we're just here to make a stance and say that we care about the future of our society, and that's what we're doing here.
Mm. And do you think that the university is going to listen to you? What do you expect the eventual outcome of this stand to be?
We have no idea.
And those are the voices of two students I spoke with yesterday occupying Campbell Hall that they had renamed Carter Huggins Hall on the campus of UCLA. And the news that we're hearing now is that as of yesterday evening, that occupation had ended. And there are a number of websites about where you can find more information about what's happening at UCLA and how students are responding across the UC campuses. One of them is UCLAResists.blogspot.com. Late this past Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid released the Senate's version of the highly anticipated health care bill. According to analysts, the bill is designed to appeal broadly to moderates and also to reduce the government deficit. Senator Reid referred to it as a jobs bill, but details of the bill reveal that it is fairly similar to the House version that passed recently, including a government-backed insurance plan, or so-called public option. According to the Boston Globe, the bill would, quote, require almost everyone to have insurance, penalize employers who fail to provide affordable coverage to their employees, and prohibit insurers from discriminating against people because of pre-existing medical conditions. On the issue of abortion coverage, the Senate bill is less restrictive than the House version. Predictably, Republicans are determined to oppose the bill, and some have even threatened to require the entire 2,000-page bill to be read out loud on the floor of the Senate, an act that could take days. A procedural vote on whether to bring the bill to the Senate floor may take place as early as tomorrow. My guest is Clark Newhall. He is a doctor and lawyer and executive director of Health Justice. He joins us on the phone now. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Do you agree with the Boston Globe that the Senate bill is fairly similar to the House bill in as far as what you have seen of it or found out about it?
It's very similar. The flaws in the House bill are duplicated in the Senate bill. The very few things that one could applaud in the House bill are likewise duplicated. The few differences have to do with how the taxes that are purportedly going to support this health insurance reform are raised, and then some differences in the abortion amendment. So basically what the House passed and what the Senate is working on is an anti-abortion bill. It's not has very little to do with health care. And it has a little bit to do with health insurance.
Well, let's talk about the abortion issue, because in the House bill, the Stupak Amendment, as it's been called, basically required that insurance companies could not cover, and certainly any tax money could not cover, abortion procedures. So what is the difference here with the Senate bill? What exactly does the Senate bill say on it?
Well, my understanding is that the Senate bill is slightly less restrictive than the House bill was. The Senate bill is basically a repetition of the Hyde Amendment that says federal dollars can't be used to directly support abortion, but that or pay for abortion, but that I don't think it contains the more restrictive language in the House bill that has to do with the ability to buy insurance policies that do cover abortion.
So there is some political, fear-mongering that's going on around this bill as well. And now the names of those senators who may try to obstruct this bill, Democratic senators, those names are coming up. And, of course, chief among them is Senator Joe Lieberman. But there's also Ben Nelson, Blanche Lincoln, and Mary Landrieu. What do you think are the roadblocks that they're going to put up, regardless of the fact that this is a flawed bill, as you've pointed out?
Well, they don't really have to put up any roadblocks. They simply have to fail to vote for cloture. Basically, there are 60 Democratic caucus members. Lieberman's not a Democrat. And Bernie Sanders from Vermont is in the Democratic caucus, but he's a socialist, or independent, I guess. And so the entire Democratic caucus, 60 people, is going to have to vote to invoke cloture to send this bill to the Senate floor. And if Harry Reid can't get 60 votes to invoke to shut off a filibuster, then the bill doesn't go anywhere. It never gets anywhere. If Harry Reid does get 60 votes and sends the bill to the floor, then the bill that he'll be sending to the floor is actually the House bill. He'll then move to amend that bill to substitute his version of health reform, what we are calling the Senate version. Then there'll be various other amendments offered, and probably, even though typically in the Senate the procedure is sort of very rapid because nobody raises any very many roadblocks at that point to a bill. In this case, that won't happen. There will be a lot of motions for consideration and so forth raised by the Republicans. There will be a lot of amendments offered on the floor of the Senate and so forth and so on. It'll take quite a while before anything gets to a bill vote, if it ever gets there. My personal opinion is that, having heard Joe Lieberman on this issue, that my opinion is that he will not vote to invoke cloture. Therefore, the filibuster will not be broken, and the bill will never get to the Senate floor anyway.
Let's take a listen to what Harry Reid had to say when he introduced his version of this bill.
The American people, President Obama, have asked us for health insurance reform that does two things. One, makes it more affordable for the American people. Remember, this past year, 750,000 Americans filed bankruptcy. Over half of those bankruptcies dealt with health care costs. More than half the people who filed bankruptcy because of health care costs had insurance. We're not going to add a dime to the deficit. In fact, quite the opposite. We'll cut the problems we have with money around here by as much as $750 billion. I want to repeat, we not only protect Medicare, we're making it stronger. This for our economy's renewal. This is a jobs bill, and the finish line is really in sight.
That's Senator Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, who introduced the Senate version of the health care bill. My guest is Clark Newhall, Executive Director of Health Justice. Do you think, Clark, that from a purely strategic perspective, that connecting this bill to jobs and economic renewal and reducing the deficit is, does this seem to be sort of new Democratic strategy, and could it work?
I don't think there's any connection, and I don't think that Harry Reid's assertion that there's a connection is going to last as a rhetorical method to claim that the bill will create jobs. I think he threw that in as a sort of a desperate attempt to justify what he's doing. But there's not a shred of evidence that it will create jobs.
I mean, does he mean in the government sector in terms of those who might be able to administer a government-backed insurance option? Is that where jobs could be created?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he means that. And I don't think he means that. I don't actually know what he's referring to, because there is not a shred of evidence that this version of health insurance reform or the House version of health insurance reform will create new jobs. In fact, it's likely to reduce jobs, because what will happen if these bills pass in anything like their present form is that there will be a mandate on individuals like you and me, and on employers probably, to purchase health insurance from private insurance companies. Now, that means that the private insurance companies are going to have something like 20 to 30 million new mandated customers, most of whom are younger and are healthy. That means that the very larger companies like WellPoint, Regence, Aetna, Cigna, are going to see a very huge jump in their profits. And they will use that to buy smaller health insurers. That's something that's been happening in the industry for a while now, in consolidation. But that will accelerate, so that there will be a few very large health insurers and not very many small health insurers. And the very large ones, of course, once they consolidate, the way they save money to justify the consolidation is they fire people. That's the way, you know, when you buy a company, you do your best to cut down the number of people that you have employed in both companies. That's how you save money, by buying companies. That's what will happen in health insurance. So, you know, as far as insurance company jobs go, there will be fewer of them.
Although advocates of single-payer health care and Medicare for All, that is part of the solution anyway. I mean, not specifically saying that we want to eliminate all jobs for people in the health insurance sector, but that the health insurance industry itself is an unnecessary industry, right?
That's true, but in single-payer health care, the evidence shows, and there is a study by the California Nurses Association issued beginning of last year, that shows that enacting single-payer health care in the form of Medicare for All, as exemplified by John Conyers' bill in the House, would create something like 2 million new jobs. Where would those come from? Well, they would come from all the people who now have no way to get health care, beginning to seek health care. And so you add 50 million new people into the pool of people who are cared for by the health care system. That means you've got to have a whole lot of new health care workers.
You need nurses, et cetera. Right.
Not just doctors, but nurses, nurse aides, people who can help people negotiate the medical care system, all those sorts of things. So the only evidence as to new jobs in any of the proposals is the evidence put out by the California Nurses Association that single-payer health care would create a lot of new jobs.
Well, finally, Clark Newhall, what about the state's options to have some kind of single-payer-like experiment at the state level? Is that something that the Senate version of the bill included?
No, and that was shot down in the House as well, the Kucinich Amendment.
Right.
At this point in time, it is illegal. I'm sorry. Not illegal. There is a legal roadblock to any state that wants to enact a single-payer system within its own borders, and that legal roadblock is called ERISA. What it basically means is that any big company that has an insurance plan of its own can say to the state, hey, forget it. We're not going to participate in your single-payer system in your state. That effectively means that states cannot enact single-payer health care. Now, Bernie Sanders, the Vermont independent, has a bill in the Senate he is proposing an amendment to the Senate bill which would allow states to enact their own single-payer system and basically would make it so that the ERISA roadblock no longer exists. That bill has very little chance of being tacked on.
But in terms of
opt-in and opt-out provisions of the Senate bill simply are provisions that say, hey, you state, if you don't like the idea of having a public option, then you can drop out of that and just have nothing but private insurance.
So that's the only option right now on the table. Lovely. Well, so in terms of what listeners who are proponents of single-payer health care can do, one thing that they can at least, if they want, call their representatives to do is to support the Sanders Amendment, regardless of the likelihood of it passing. But, well, there's always some hope, depending upon how people respond, don't you say?
Yeah, people can go to our website, which is, you know, if you Google the two words together, health justice, that's the first thing that pops up. Our website is www.onepayer.net. And there's a fax mechanism on our site, and this is also on some other sites, but it allows you to send a free fax to your representatives, and there's a number of ones you can choose. You can write your own. You can edit the ones that are on there. But it sends a free fax to your representatives addressing the issue of single payer.
That's onepayer.net, the number onepayer.net. My guest has been Clark Newhall, Executive Director of Health Justice. He's also a doctor and a lawyer. Thanks so much, Clark, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Uprising. We've just been discussing the Senate version of the health care bill, which could come to the floor of the Senate as early as tomorrow. Well, they're taking a procedural vote as of now on deciding whether or not to discuss the bill. This is we're going to take a short break for today's Subversive Historian. And later in the hour, Antonia Juhas will join us to go to Iraq and see what has happened with the oil business there. Plus, this week's Black Agenda report focuses on Afghan President Hamid Karzai. And we'll also take a look at a very important federal ruling that just took place earlier this week against the Army Corps of Engineers being held liable for the damages in New Orleans and surrounding areas, because of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Stay tuned.
Let me welcome both of you to the show this morning to talk about what I consider to be a very, very important topic.
Hip-hop music is back on KPFK.
Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition.
Tune in to Breakbeats and Rhymes late Saturday nights from 2 to 4 a.m. here on KPFK 90.7 FM throughout Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego. 98.7 for your heads in Santa Barbara and live worldwide at kpfk.org. Saturday nights, 2 to 4 a.m. So join us on your drive home from the clubs or parties, or as you're just chilling at home. Tune in across the globe. Download past shows. See the playlist online at kpfk.org. That's Breakbeats and Rhymes late Saturday nights from 2 to 4.
Sigue la rutina. Get my history, a mystery, but now I see.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on November 20th, 1969, a group of nearly 80 native people sailed to the abandoned island of Alcatraz and occupied it. Once upon the grounds of the former federal penitentiary, the activists issued a proclamation to the Great White Father and his people. The words of the document read, quote, "We are on Alcatraz Island to make known to the world that we have a right to use our land for our own benefit," and ended with the emphatic slogan, "We hold the rock." The occupation that began 40 years ago today demanded that the U.S. government recognize Native people's claim to the territory so that they could develop numerous institutions, including spiritual, educational, and ecological centers. For the next 18 months, the federal government waited out the occupation and never acquiesced to its demands. On June 11, 1971, federal marshals arrived to remove the final 15 activists from the rock that had been held. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. A federal judge's ruling on Wednesday against the Army Corps of Engineers has finally confirmed what many Gulf Coast residents have known for the past 4 years, that the flooding caused by Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was in fact a man-made disaster. In his 189-page ruling, Judge Stanwood Duvall wrote, quote, "The Corps' lassitude and failure to fulfill its duties resulted in a catastrophic loss of human life and property in unprecedented proportions. Furthermore, the Corps not only knew but admitted by 1988 that the MRGO, that's the Mississippi Gulf River Outlet, threatened human life, and yet it did not act in time to prevent the catastrophic disaster that ensued with the onslaught of Hurricane Katrina. The suit in question was brought by three homeowners and one business owner, who are to be awarded $720,000 in damages. The Times-Picayune in New Orleans estimates that the ruling sets a precedent that could encourage 100,000 more lawsuits. However, the government is expected to veto the ruling. My guest is Amanda Moore. She is the National Wildlife Federation's Coastal Louisiana organizer. Welcome to Uprising, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. First, for those of us here on the West Coast, explain the Mississippi Gulf River Outlet, MRGO, that many refer to colloquially as Mr. Go. How exactly was that, in the view of many residents, responsible for the flooding that caused the damage? It wasn't really the hurricane. Many people wrote out the hurricane, but then the rising waters and the breaking of the levees and the flooding is what caused the damage. Is that correct?
Right. The Mississippi River Gulf Outlet as a 76-mile deep draft channel that was authorized in the 50s. It was finished in the 60s, and over time the channel grew from about 500 feet wide to over 3,000 feet wide in some areas. And this channel connects the Gulf of Mexico to the heart of New Orleans, in our inner harbor is what we call it. And along with the expansion, the widening of that channel, came a lot of degradation of wetlands that are all along the greater New Orleans area that protect the communities, and they help protect levees from storm surge. And so this ecosystem had been so degraded that when the way that Hurricane Katrina came in, it actually, along with another channel that New Orleans is a port town, so along with another channel that had been cut through, what some of the the experts argued in the case is that it created a storm surge, like a funnel effect, which kind of rushed water, in a great wall of water into the New Orleans area, and it just totally destroyed a lot of the levees along that Mississippi River Gulf outlet that protect communities like the Lower Ninth Ward and Chalmette.
Well, many residents had for years now been saying that this exactly was the case, as you mentioned, but it was almost impossible to get any kind of a lawsuit to succeed, at least during the Bush administration's era, it was impossible to get a judge to rule that the Army Corps of Engineers was, in fact, liable. How significant is this ruling that took place Wednesday?
Well, this same judge had actually ruled a few years ago that the Corps was not liable for some of the canal flooding that happened in New Orleans. So because this was a navigational channel, it kind of changed the liability of the Corps. And this ruling is really significant in part because of the NEPA discussion that occurred, the National Environmental Policy Act discussion, saying that the Corps, in a way, it defines its mission too narrowly. It just kept dredging this channel and operating and maintaining the channel without taking into consideration the public health and safety aspects, the environmental degradation that was occurring along with their maintenance of the channel and the existence of the channel. So this is saying that they need to look at the cumulative impacts of what they're doing. And so this can actually apply to a lot of coastal Louisiana, which is experiencing some of the most rapid rates of wetland loss in the world. And so it's really going to hopefully reform the way that the Corps looks at their mission and to take into a more holistic view of how their actions will impact the communities and the ecosystems. And there are, in the area, in the Ninth Ward in Chalmette, there's about 100,000 other residences or residents that are now, you know, it could be possible for them to bring suit against the federal government. So we'll see, you know, how it all plays out, but it is a really big deal down here for liability in the Corps.
And it is, however, the government is expected to appeal the ruling, and we'll see where that leads. Now, I want to talk to you about the natural storm buffer, the wetlands that you mentioned earlier, and how the construction, the use and the maintenance of the MRG, or the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, destroyed the storm buffer. Explain that to us, and what are the what hope is there to revive that, to bring that back? Because, there will be more hurricanes in the future.
Exactly. And that's a concern that a lot of the residents have had here for a long time, since even the beginning initial plans for the channel. In the 50s, the newspapers are talking about, is this going to be doom for us? People are out protesting on the beaches saying, don't do this, because people are really in tune to their environment down here, this deltaic ecosystem. And so people realized the importance of the wetlands and knew that when you dig a deep draft channel from the Gulf of Mexico straight through into the heart of New Orleans, all the communities, there are some densely populated communities not far from that channel, and the wetlands, you know, we're going to have to succumb to saltwater intrusion, which is exactly what happened. There were big, fresh cypress forests outside of the Lower Ninth Ward, and, you know, at one point. And after, you saw, like, the change from 1950 to today with that ecosystem along the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, because of saltwater intrusion and just the degradation, the widening of the channel, it's all a lot of it is open salt water now, right on the other side of the levees, which is what, you know, made the levees so vulnerable, made the communities so vulnerable. Before, there were, you know, cypress forests, freshwater marsh, brackish marsh, and that ecosystem has drastically changed. And with it comes a lot of you know, increased vulnerability, it really puts the communities at risk.
So who should pay for the revival of this, assuming it can be revived? Should it be the Army Corps of Engineers, the government in general? And are there efforts to make such a thing happen?
It actually is going on right now. In the Water Resources and Development Act of 2007, after Katrina, the Congress told the Corps that they need to close the channel to navigation, and they also need to restore the channel, restore the ecosystem along the Mississippi River Gulf outlet that was degraded and destroyed. And so they actually, earlier this year, they built a dam, a rock dam, that was about 40 miles south of New Orleans on the channel, and it cuts off the channel. And so what you've seen happen because of that, it's close to navigation. And you've seen the salt water, the levels of salinity have gone down north of that lock dam that they've built. However, the next step, which is really the critical step, is to restore the wetlands. And that is happening right now. The Corps is working on it. And also the community is working on it. I coordinate the Mr. Go, Must Go Coalition. It's 17 environmental, social justice, community organizations that are working together to help guide the Corps as to what we want to see happen. We have scientists, experts, policy experts working with us to say that, you know, these are the different projects that need to be implemented. And it needs to be a top priority, and it needs to be done carefully. So the community is really engaged in working with the Corps to make sure that this area is restored, and so that protection is restored. So it's something that, you know, long before this decision was made and this lawsuit, the community has been very aware and very active to restore this area.
Amanda Moore is my guest, National Wildlife Federation's Coastal Louisiana organizer. She's also she leads the Mr. Go Must Go Coalition. Mr. Go, again, MRGO, which is the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. And so at this point, you're saying that the Army Corps are cooperating with you and with the coalition you're working with and actually trying to do the right thing?
That's right. That's right. They are. And we're waiting to see that. The one thing to note is that Congress actually set a deadline, you know, after the 2007 Water Resources and Development Act told them to close and restore this ecosystem. The deadline was May of 2008 from Congress for the Corps to have a plan for restoration. And so while they're working with us, we have to note that it is now, you know, November of 2010, they're thinking that they're going to have a plan out hopefully by November 2009. They think they're going to have a plan out by May of 2010. So there is a lot of concern and some disappointment that it hasn't been, that this restoration effort has not been prioritized. So that's something that the coalition is working really strongly to make sure that it's a priority, that they stay as much as they can on a timeline to get this done.
And, you know, every year, of course, that passes without this being done, there's a risk of more hurricanes and similar things happening. Amanda Moore, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And what's the website for the Mr. Go Must Go Coalition?
It's www.mrgomustgo.org. And you can go online and learn more about the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet and also take action.
That's mrgomustgo.org. Amanda, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Amanda Moore, again, is the National Wildlife Federation's Coastal Louisiana organizer and leads the Mr. Go Must Go Coalition in the Gulf region. We've been talking about a federal ruling, the first of its kind, that took place Wednesday, where a federal judge ruled the Army Corps of Engineers was liable for the damages caused by the flooding from Hurricane Katrina, that in fact it was a man-made disaster. This is Uprising, and after today's Black Agenda report about Afghan President Hamid Karzai, we're going to hear about how multinational consortiums are seeking oil deals in Iraq. My guest will be Antonia Juhas. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda report. This week's commentary is on Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
In the last days of 2001, following the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the Americans handpicked Hamid Karzai to head that country's new puppet government. 8 years later, Washington is blaming Karzai for most, if not all, that has gone wrong with the U.S. occupation. Before and after Karzai's attempt to rig his re-election in August, various U.S. generals and politicians, including President Obama, made it clear that they wished Karzai would drop dead or otherwise disappear from the scene. The U.S. occupiers seemed to totally miss the irony in the fact that it was they who had rigged Karzai's initial rise to power and subsequent election in 2004. Rigged elections are fine when engineered by the U.S., but when the puppet pulls his own strings, it's a crime. It is bizarre in the extreme how nation-stealers and occupiers cannot bear to see their own boundless corruption reflected in the faces of their third-world hirelings. Karzai was selected to be the Americans' frontman in Afghanistan precisely because of his advanced criminal skills and total absence of loyalty to his own country. These are the qualities that made him attractive to the Americans in the first place, his willingness to participate in crimes against his own nation for a price. Freelancing, however, can get you killed by the boss of all bosses in Washington. Such is the law of the imperial gangster jungle. Karzai's brother, Ahmed, has long been rumored to be a major drug lord. He's also the council chief in Kandahar province, which is the heartland of the Taliban. The Americans pretend that the drug trade is the moneymaker that finances the Taliban. But in fact, Afghan heroin has expanded to more than 90% of the world market since the Americans and the Karzai brothers took over the country. The same thing happened with Colombian cocaine after the Americans intervened in that country's civil war. The international cocaine and heroin connections are actually facilitations of the American government, specifically the CIA. So it is hilarious to hear Americans expressing shock and disgust that Karzai brother Ahmed, the reputed drug lord, has been on the CIA's payroll for the last 8 years. Well, of course he has. That's what the CIA does. Their modus operandi throughout the Third World is to recruit criminal elements to subvert their own countries to America's will. In return, these favored criminals are awarded franchises in the drug trade and other illicit enterprises. The road to American empire is paved with one criminal enterprise and subversion after another. Two other brothers in service to America come to mind. Ngo Dinh Diem became the American puppet in South Vietnam when the French were forced out. His brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, became chief of the secret police, the top communist killer. But by 1963, the two brothers who had served the Americans so loyally had fallen out of favor. They were killed in an American-backed coup just 3 weeks before President Kennedy was himself assassinated. The Karzai brothers in Afghanistan are no doubt aware of the historical parallels. But then, gangsters get into the life with their eyes open. The boss can always turn on you, and the Americans usually do. Just ask Saddam Hussein. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Iraqi oil officials are scheduled to meet with a consortium of Japanese companies on Sunday to finalize a development deal on the Nasiriya oil field. The negotiations follow a first round of bidding for lucrative contracts earlier this summer by several multinational oil corporations. Only the consortium comprised of British Petroleum and the Chinese National Petroleum Corporation emerged with agreed-upon terms for the largest oil field in Iraq last summer. But government oil officials have since made negotiations much more appealing to bidders. Earlier this month, ExxonMobil was able to win a $50 billion contract and in doing so became the first U.S.-based oil company to reach a deal with Iraq in 35 years. 45 international oil companies will be seeking future developmental deals on 15 oil fields in the country as a highly competitive second round of bidding is scheduled to start on December 11th. Iraqi oil minister Hussein Shahrastani characterized his nation's move away from nationalized production by saying, "After decades of oppression and tyranny, Iraq is getting back its riches for this generation and for the next." Resistance within Iraq and around the world, however, has thus far prevented the passage of the so-called Iraq oil law that would further open the country's reserves to multinational corporations. My guest is Antonia Juhas. She's the director of the Chevron Program at Global Exchange and author of the book The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. The book is coming out in paperback on December 8th. Welcome to Uprising, Antonia.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, we're not hearing much about Iraq in the news these days, but in stepping back, one thing is quite obvious. Under Saddam Hussein's rule, foreign oil companies did not have access to the vast Iraqi oil reserves. Now they do. And that sums up quite nicely much of the motives for the Bush administration going to war in the first place, would you say?
Yeah, and unfortunately, what's happening is that while I and many others around the world followed very closely and helped to bring a pretty big spotlight to the resistance in Iraq to the Bush administration and U.S. oil companies' attempt to pass a new national oil law for Iraq that would privatize Iraq's oil, and that got a lot of attention and has since been stymied. These contract negotiations that are not quite as beneficial to the foreign oil companies, not everything they had hoped for, but still, as you say, essentially they did not have access to Iraqi oil, and through signing these contracts, they will now, for the first time in 35 years, have production contracts in Iraq, are really passing through and being signed and moving forward very quickly, very much under the radar, such that if the next round of negotiations, which are slated to begin in early December, if they conclude very quickly, which they're expected to, we will see U.S. and British oil companies producing oil in Iraq on terms that are being discussed in a very non-transparent manner and in a way that could really lock, if they lock our oil companies into Iraq, as the oil companies hope they will, my fear is they could also lock our soldiers and private contractors, our military presence in Iraq for significantly a longer period of time as well.
Who are the Iraqi negotiators and what are their motives here and how representative are they of those forces on the ground resisting the war, union workers, etc.?
Well, it's as in everything, it's very complicated in post-invasion Iraq. On the Iraqi side doing the negotiations is the Iraq Oil Ministry, and it's supported by the cabinet, which is the prime minister, the president, and the two vice presidents. And that group has been aggressively hoping to get first an oil law passed on behalf, essentially, of the Bush administration and now contract signed. And I think the reasons for that are complicated, but one is clear. It's that the current government, the prime minister, the president, the vice presidents, and the cabinet, really many of them owe their continued political life to the invasion, to the foreign military forces, and need to placate those forces to a degree. Now, where resistance is coming is in the much more democratically elected and diverse parliament in Iraq, which has been resisting the oil law, which has also, members of which have said that they think these contracts are illegal, and resistance has also come from mass social movements in Iraq. As you said, the unions, women's organizations, peace organizations, just generalized citizens' resistance, which doesn't also get covered, but has taken the form of traditional protest, marches, traditional protests, nonviolent civil disobedience, letter writing, and the like, which has really succeeded in stopping the law, and laws are easier to follow. What's a lot harder to follow is individual contract negotiations between, you know, the largest corporations the world has ever known and an Iraqi government that's in a very, you know, precarious political position.
My guest is Antonia Juhas. She's the director of the Chevron Program at Global Exchange and author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. By the way, she's going to be in Los Angeles on December 17th. She'll be speaking at the Coalition for a Safe Environment at 6:30 p.m. That address is 1601 North Wilmington Boulevard. Again, that's December 17th at 6:30 p.m. at the Coalition for Safe Environment, 1601 North Wilmington. So, Antonia, why has the Iraqi parliament delayed a vote on the oil law until after the 2010 elections? What exactly is their motivation there?
Well, there's just been so much opposition to the law. The law would do at least two things that are problematic to the parliament. One is really open up Iraq on the most lucrative terms possible to foreign oil companies, open up Iraq to those foreign oil companies, giving them very long-term contracts and production decision control and ownership, essentially.
So are you saying that this is almost a sort of delaying tactic to get terms set into place so that they could be sort of grandfathered in, regardless of what the oil law says?
Well, so the parliament has decided to delay the law till after the election because they oppose the law. And they're trying to say, we have other things to deal with. We don't want this law passed.
So their motivation is sound here.
Their motivation is sound, from my perspective. What the government is trying, or what the cabinet is trying to do, is get contracts in now, get them in, given the delay in the law, given
okay,
the
so
uncertainty.
They're taking advantage of the delay then. Well, look, what's the significance of the ExxonMobil contract? This is a company you know very well. So it has just won a major contract. And what exactly, I mean, does this mean that ExxonMobil has essentially won?
Well, ExxonMobil, yeah, I mean, has a huge contract for one of the largest oil fields on the planet. They've signed this contract. You know, the terms are not all that they had hoped for, but they're very generous. And, you know, the terms are a 20 to 25-year long contract. It doesn't give the company ownership over the oil fields that they would have liked, and it doesn't give them the profit calculus that they would like. Now, none of this is a done deal, and nobody can be declared a winner until the contracts are, you know, literally signed and the company gets to work, which means that, you know, while these negotiations continue, there is still a tremendous opportunity for sunlight to be shown on this process and real information to be exposed so that Iraqis can learn more about what's happening and so we can learn more about what's happening to hold our companies and our government to account. You know, until the first oil company sets up shop in Iraq, none of this is done. And it is a huge victory for Exxon to have been shut out of Iraq for 35 years and to now get the opportunity to produce in the most abundant fields essentially left on the planet. And it's not just Exxon. So Exxon's partnering with Shell. We have also California's Occidental Petroleum Company has signed in with Italy's Eni for a huge field. Chevron is getting ready to join negotiations for the Majnoon field, another one of the largest fields on the planet.
So the usual suspects, basically.
It's the usual suspects, and it's happening now. Mm. And so the victory of the organizing thus far has been denial of the Dream Prize, right? But while the denial of the Dream Prize has been achieved by organizing and sunlight being shown on this process, the contract negotiations have proceeded, and they've developed a very unique hybrid model of a contract that isn't like any other contract really on the planet, that gives the company some good stuff and gives the Iraqis some good stuff. And you know, the key is to now be watching these negotiations, trying to learn and expose more of the terms, and trying to ensure that if they do move forward, that it is, in fact, a legal process in Iraq, that it is a transparent process, and that it is not a process that's going to create much more hostility towards the United States and also require the continuation of U.S. troops there.
Well, Antonia, spell out for us what is it specifically that Iraqis have won and what the what the oil companies have not gotten. I mean, if the oil companies had gotten exactly what they had asked for, of course, they would be quite happy. So what were those perhaps minutiae that we need to know that they lost out on?
Well, there's two important aspects. One is that actually before the invasion, and this is a very important part of the timeline, Saddam Hussein had been trying to get the sanctions removed that were being imposed on Iraq by trying to sign oil contracts with companies from countries on the Security Council, which were imposing the sanctions. So that was most importantly and largely France, companies from France and from China, and I'm forgetting one of the countries, but that's all right, it'll come back to me. And he was signing contracts, but none of them could be implemented unless the sanctions were removed. And we know now that as part of the Cheney Energy Task Force, the Bush administration and U.S. oil companies came together and looked at this list and looked at these contracts and saw that no American companies were part of this list, no British companies were part of this list, and if the sanctions were removed, all of that oil would go to all of those foreign oil companies and the U.S. would be shut out. Well, basically what we're seeing now in these contracts is the U.S. and British oil companies edging their way into these deals and essentially the invasion serving the function of getting our oil companies in on these deals, and the deals have been sweetened. So we've got much longer contract terms than in a traditional contract of this type. So as opposed to 2 to 3 years, the contracts are 20 to 25 years.
That's an enormous increase. We're talking about decades here at a time when, you know, much of the world's people are hoping that we're going to be moving away from oil because the planet is warming. I mean, 25 years, we may not have much life left on this planet if we continue at our current pace.
Well, it's a critically important point as we move into the climate negotiations mm-hmm. in Copenhagen, and oil is, you know, the largest contributor in the United States to our carbon footprint. An enormous amount of the oil being produced in Iraq is already coming to the United States. We can imagine that a larger percentage would come our way if it was our companies actually producing the oil. And it's still foggy as to who ultimately has the production decision-making, whether it is the foreign company or Iraq.
Now, will that be decided in the second round of bidding?
It's already decided by somebody. It's just in the minutiae of the contract, mm-hmm. and we don't get to see that.
Okay. And finally, Antonia, let's talk about media coverage of this very important development, the sort of end point of the occupation. It seems as though the financial media has been the only ones really covering these bidding rounds. Do you think that the mainstream media, as well as the anti-war movements, have they sort of missed this story, despite all of the sloganeering right from the start of No War for Oil?
I think most certainly it's really just been, as you say, the financial press covering the contracts. I think, yes, that there is the anti-war movement has stayed somewhat abreast of these issues, but it has certainly not been enough, and it's certainly not been enough to maintain the focus that's needed to ensure that this process is transparent, because at the end of the day, it will not only will it not look good if U.S. oil companies end up being, you know, the lasting presence in Iraq following the occupation, but if that requires the occupation to last. And the media, mainstream media, has not covered this as they should. The anti-war movement has not covered it as we should, and the broader public hasn't. And part of the result of that is that the Obama administration has really picked up where the Bush administration led off in pushing for terms that allow U.S. oil companies to operate in Iraq. And I don't believe that that is because the Obama administration is as wed to the oil industry as is the Bush administration. I think it's because we have not applied the appropriate pressure to the Obama administration, as is the oil industry applying its own pressure. So unless we respond with the same level of demand that this is not what we think the administration should be doing, it's going to fall under the pressure of this industry, which is, of course, the wealthiest the world has ever known today.
Well, that's a very good point. Antonia Juhas, I want to thank you, as always, for bringing light to these issues. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you in December.
Thanks for having me.
Antonia Juhas is director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange and author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. It's going to be out in paperback on December 8th, and she'll be in L.A. December 17th at 6:30 p.m. at the Coalition for Safe Environment. That's located at 1601 North Wilmington Boulevard. And we'll link to her new article called Did Big Oil Win the War in Iraq, which was published on Alternet from our site later today at kpfk.org/uprising. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, I thought I'd quote Bernie Madoff, who once said, "The nature of any human being, certainly anyone on Wall Street, is that the better at the deal you give the customer, the worse deal it is for you." That's Bernie Madoff, and that's Sonali, subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. See you Monday at 8.